Robin Young. It's here and now, and there's a good chance you're not out shopping. Today, the Commerce Department reports that Americans are cutting back on spending by the largest amount since the 9/11 attacks. Later in the program, reporter David Leonhardt on when that federal bailout money might trickle down to someone who will actually spend it. But first, part of the cutback in consumer spending is in travel. AAA says travel will decline this Thanksgiving for the first time in 7 years, even though gas prices are down 33% from last year. Travel expert Rudy Maxa is here. Rudy, is this a time to travel?
Robin, this is the time to travel. There are deals everywhere. First of all, the dollar's way up compared to 3 or 4 months ago and certainly a year ago in most foreign countries. And there are deals. In Santa Fe, the El Dorado Hotel and Spa, where it costs about $200 a night, will give you, for every night you stay, a free spa treatment valued at $130. So your room is effectively $70 a night.
So people are trying to lure people in, but we understand there are catches. Now, we have a colleague flying to London. He's so excited. He got $170 round-trip tickets, but then nearly
$500. $170 round-trip tickets?
Yeah.
From whom?
Well,
that's ridiculous.
But yes, and that's the point. They turned out to have $500 worth of fees tagged on.
Oh,
so they went up to, you know, almost $700. Tell us about these embedded fees.
Well, first of all, you have a lot of fuel surcharges that have been piled on top of each other the last couple of years by the airlines. And they're not rushing, as you might imagine, to remove them, even though the cost of fuel has plummeted, because they're still trying to dig out of the hole they've been in for the last couple of years. But the example, to have $500 in extra charges on a $170 ticket is ridiculous. That's just not right.
Okay, well, we'll maybe send him to you. You can find out more about that. But we should say, too, even flying domestically, another colleague flying to Baltimore had a federal segment tax, whatever that is, airport passenger facility charges. These were much less, you know, a 9/11 security fee, but they add up.
Oh, they do add up, and those have been around for quite a while, the ones you just mentioned. And then on top of that, airlines are serving you basically their services a la carte, as a hotel or a restaurant would. You know, if you want a bag of nuts, it may cost you more on some airlines. If you want to check a second bag, it may cost you more. They're being a little more strict about the weight on bags. But where you really find those fees you were mentioning, Robin, is on rental cars. I have rented a car and had it cost $30 a day, and the fee's been $28 a day. Where cities are trying to build stadiums or reduce debt or build something or other. And so rather than taxing the hometown folks who will yell and scream, they say, let's tax those out-of-towners. They can't vote us out of office. Hmm. So they slam these huge fees on rental cars, particularly when you pick them up at airports.
Okay, so check for fees, every mode of travel. Rudy Maxa, give us another tip for travel.
Well, if you're going to a big city, try to go on weekends, if you're going for leisure, that is, because that's when business travelers aren't there and hotels will have weekend deals. Go to the website of resorts. For example, the Beaver Creek Park Hyatt will give you a third night free plus a room upgrade and full breakfast for two daily if you book their 3-for-free package. But you might not know that if you don't go to their website. You know, the Fairfax County, which is right outside of Washington, D.C., they have a whole handful of hotels offering you stay for two nights on a weekend, and whatever you pay on Saturday night, whatever the temperature is that day. So it's 32 degrees, you pay $32 that night at, say, a Marriott. So there are all kinds of special offers out there if you go searching for them.
Well, and if you ask.
So you can bargain with hoteliers for free breakfast, free parking, a room upgrade, whatever, you know, a bottle of wine at dinner in their restaurant.
Okay, a couple other tips for travel over the Thanksgiving holiday. We understand there's a company that now functions in over 65 airports in the U.S. and Canada where you can book a parking spot reservation in advance online. We'll have this at our website. It's airportparkingreservations.com. A great idea for some of these airports.
It is a great idea if you want to park. My better idea is you don't drive to the airport, no matter where you live, because while you may be able to book a spot, it may be, you know, three golf course lengths away from the terminal. If you can take public transportation to the airport over Thanksgiving in particular, do it. It'll save you a lot of wear and tear, both coming and going.
Okay. And if you're picking someone up at the other end of a flight, there's a service you say has been around for a while where you can watch their flight travel across country and know when to get them.
FlightView.com will let you do that. But also, find out, whoever you're picking up, find out from them what airline they're flying and what flight they're flying. Almost every airline's website, now you just type it in and it'll give you up to the minute on what time it's expected to land. And do that when the flight's, you know, getting close to your hometown and you got to leave for the airport.
Rudy Maxa of the public television series Rudy Maxa's World at Maxa.tv, also contributing editor for National Geographic Traveler magazine. And Rudy, I wish you a safe travels on Thanksgiving.
And you too, Robin. Thank you.
Well, we are on the eve of Thanksgiving, the beginning of the holiday season, a wonderful time of year, except when it's not. For the late author William Styron, Thanksgiving was the portal to the bleak emotional landscape of winter. Styron died of November 1, 2006, at the age of 81, leaving a legacy of passionate novels from his Pulitzer Prize-winning The Confessions of Nat Turner to Sophie's Choice, the excruciating story of the Polish Holocaust survivor forced by Nazis to choose which one of her two children will survive the camps, which will die. But Styron also left us a greater understanding of depression. We spoke to his widow, Rose, two Thanksgivings ago, just after Styron passed away. And we want to revisit that conversation today because of the insight she gives us into this often melancholy season. Rose Styron is a poet and human rights activist in her own right, but she was also a friend and supporter of a circle of men who battled depression. She told us hundreds of people wrote to her after William Styron's death about the impact of his work.
They talk about his generosity, his gentleness, his humanity, his love of the world and all the people in it who are suffering or who are joyous, as he was by turn.
Well, this time of year, a lot of families wrestle with the suffering, depression. Was your husband's depression seasonal? You know, it's darker outside, the leaves have fallen, it's gray on Martha's Vineyard. Was this time harder for him?
He hated the coming of fall. He hated not fall itself, but the anticipation of cold and of winter. And Thanksgiving was sort of his last moment of pleasure, being with his family around the dinner table, and recently having all his children and his grandchildren around for Thanksgivings. And after that, he hated Christmas. He hated January and February in the cold, and he hated the shortening, darkening of the days, yeah, as you suggested.
You know, I want to talk more about that, but we want to remind ourselves of the bibliography, and then maybe, you know, how much was the incredible writing because of the depression a side effect, or did it perhaps help cause it? But just to remind ourselves, you know, that the first big work, Lie Down in Darkness, about a young Southern girl's suicide, that was in 1951. Then we skip to 67, when Bill won the Pulitzer Prize for The Confessions of Nat Turner. That, of course, is told from the point of view of the historical figure who led the failed slave insurrection before the Civil War. That book, you know, first acclaimed and then sparked an outcry from black writers who said, you know, a white man couldn't write the black man's experience. There was a book of essays in 1968 called William Styron's Nat Turner, 10 Black Writers Respond. How tough was that for him when that criticism came?
Oh, it was tremendously tough. And in a funny way, he was scared for us, for his family. He thought maybe something would happen to us, and he was always looking outside and always wondering where we were. And I have the feeling that that sparked something very deep inward that may have led to a depression, even though the depression itself was like 18 years later.
Yeah, the full outbreak. Well, his next novel would come more than a decade later. Sophie's Choice was made into an Oscar-nominated film starring Meryl Streep with this exquisitely unbearable ending. This woman whose story is, you almost can't read it. You almost couldn't see it on the screen. It's just, even now my heart, you know, at her choice. How did he live with that, writing that?
That's a very good question, Robin, because in the first version, when he started the book, and it took him 7 years to write it, he started the book with the scene of Sophie's choice at Auschwitz, choosing which child has to die, and I freaked out. I said, you just can't start it there. You have to let that come somewhere near the end or at the end after you've created the rest of the story. I instinctively did not feel that I could bear living all the years he wrote it, knowing that this is how it started. I was afraid readers wouldn't be able to go on. That's one of the very few times I had any real input into his writing.
And I'm thinking that his writing about that choice, not averting his eyes from what really happened at Auschwitz, especially given that he had depression, was a brave thing to do.
He was. He was a very brave man, and I don't know how he wrote himself through that.
Do you think that the stories like that, or the suicide of the young girl in Lie Down in Darkness, did they unhinge the depression, or was the depression always there, and the depression was the friend that actually was able to take him to these dark stories?
I think the second. I think that's a very good way to put it, Robin. I think the books and the stories of the characters he invented, who were always himself or harboring his darkest thoughts, allowed him to write and to live.
When you say how ill he was, Kurt Vonnegut said he hated to see him end this way. Gore Vidal said he had a bad ending. Could you explain to people how bad depression gets? It's not just a bad day.
Oh, no. It's such a long, painful tunnel to be in, and you never believe you can get out of it. And when you do get out of it, you rejoice, but you know you could go right back into it again, and nobody understands. It's such a lonely place. It was physically incredibly crippling, as if the brain had ceased to direct the body in any way or to motivate the body or the spirit. And, of course, it was dreadful in his brain. He, at some points, had the cruelest delusions about himself, feeling that he had been condemned by God to limbo below Dante's imagining, limbo forever. Mm. He believed off and on that aliens had stolen his brain. Paul Theroux reminded me in a letter yesterday of a conversation they'd had where Bill was convinced that the Nazis had brought their gas machine on the ferry to Martha's Vineyard and were gassing him at the moment. There were cruel, cruel, psychotic moments which he described in such beautiful narrative that you thought he was writing a novel. It was awful for him inside. But the last year or two, there was none of that. There was no clinical depression. There was sadness and disbelief at the extraordinary physical debilitation, and his feeling of helplessness was acute, so he really didn't want, you know, to face the world every day. And I think it was only for us and for his family and friends that he came downstairs every afternoon.
Rose Styron, from our 2006 conversation about her late husband, author William Styron, who'd died just weeks prior. This music is Marvin Hamlisch's love theme from the film Sophie's Choice. When we come back, William Styron's unfinished novel. After that, today's news. Barack Obama has pulled Paul Volcker on board. We'll be back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're revisiting our conversation with Rose Styron, wife of the late author William Styron, who died in 2006 after a long bout with depression. We spoke with Rose just after. The couple once split their time between a farmhouse in Connecticut and a home on Martha's Vineyard, an idyllic life. But as Rose told us, the creeping darkness and cold of Martha's Vineyard this time of year would trigger William Styron's depression. She also told us how the island brought him great joy.
Oh, he thought it was the most beautiful place in the world, and he loved being on his porch looking at the boats going by and the children next door. He loved taking long walks in the woods and on the beaches of the vineyard. He loved especially walking with his dogs and looking, you know, at the sky and the sea and the changing light. He was really very, very happy here.
Norman Mailer said, "No other American writer of my generation has had so omnipresent and exquisite a sense of the elegiac," which in itself is a nice elegy.
It is.
Is there a way for you to convey what his loss means to the literary world?
That would be hard for me to say. I hoped and hoped these past 3 or 4 years when he was sick that he would finish the novel that he was working on. So I think that novel, completed is a loss to the literary world.
Mm. What was it about? Can you say?
It was to be called The Way of the Warrior, and it was about himself as a young man returning from the Pacific and starting his life again.
Is there any way you'd ever have someone else try to finish it, or does it freeze in time?
Yeah. No, because he kept changing his mind about where he would start and end and how he would put it together. There are many pieces of it. His wonderful editor, Bob Loomis, at Random House might be able to make something of it. I wouldn't know how to.
Hmm. Well, I want to go back to your husband's 1990 autobiographical work, Darkness Visible, a memoir of madness. He writes about his depression. He called Darkness Visible the Rosetta Stone to his other works. In other words, it helped him interpret the other works?
We thought of that when he was writing it. We talked about that a lot, how we both suddenly realized that all his other protagonists had a very dark side. That was obviously him.
What was that like to live with this man, so successful, as you said, four beautiful children, a glorious life? You would not know this, but I remember seeing you once in the company of Diane Sawyer, and I think Leontine Price was there that night at dinner, and Carly Simon, and then there was Mike Wallace, Art Buchwald, his dear friends who also suffered from depression. You know, this incredible circle of friends, this glittering life, and you, a loving, wonderful partner. Did you ever find yourself thinking, why aren't I enough? Why can't we be enough to get you out of this?
I certainly thought that the last 5 years and wished that there was something more that we could do. And I guess my role was that of cheerleader and convener of friends who would talk to him at that point. Whether we were, you know, remembering all our glorious trips together with writer friends, you know, Carlos Fuentes in Mexico, Arthur Miller, our trips to Egypt and Chile, Peter Matheson and George Plimpton to Africa and India, James Jones, year after year in Paris, Gabriel Garcia Marquez in Cuba. And in the last two summers when he was having such a struggle, they all came to talk to him, and he responded and loved being with them. And when he couldn't write these last couple of years, the conversations with the guys, as he called them all, and Sheldon Hackney would come over every day, or the gals who were closest to him, Mia Farrow in Connecticut and Meryl Streep and Tess Bramhall and Lucy Hackney and Betty de Robillard and Claire White, all of these people who he loved. And
yeah, but what you're doing, I think, I don't know if you're aware of what you're doing, is bringing a lot of comfort to families with depression, I'm guessing, because they're listening to this and they're saying depression cannot be switched off by having marvelous friends.
That's right. Yes, I hope that friendship and affection from family, affection that came and attention that came through letters would keep him alive forever. He loved the mail, and he answered every letter he could from anybody over the years and fretted that he couldn't the last couple of years because mail meant so much to him, just that kind of communication. And I thought that if he kept writing or I kept writing and his friends kept talking to him, he'd never die. Foolish thought, but very comforting at Thanksgiving.
There is a passage in Sophie's Choice where the character, Sophie, has a glass of fine French wine, and she reflects, you know, when you live a good life like a saint, that must be what they make you drink in paradise. I'm imagining he is toasting now.
I imagine he is, too. I'm sure he's up there in a cloud looking down and toasting us and laughing and saying, oh, it's another morning excellent and fair. And he's free of pain. Yeah. We hated to let him go, but he was in much pain. And we're thankful that his spirit is around, opening and closing doors we don't expect and flying down with the birds to seize a piece of our lives.
Rose Styron, a wife of the late author William Styron. Rose, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Robin. Yeah. It's the first time I've talked about Bill, and I'm really glad you made me do it.
Thank you. And our conversation with Rose Styron was recorded Thanksgiving 2006, just after William Styron passed away. Well, in a minute, we'll get you back to the news. President-elect Obama names more of his economic team and says help is on the way. That's just in a couple of minutes, here and now. It seems the government is willing to print as much money as it takes. Yesterday, the Fed pledged to pump $800 billion into credit markets. That's on top of the $700 billion Treasury Department bank bailout. The $800 billion pledge pushed interest rates on 30-year mortgages down by half a percentage point to 5.5% and set off a rush to refinance. But there are also grim reports today about increased jobless claims, decreased spending. So how much money can be thrown at this? David Leonhardt of the New York Times joins us. And David, there's a lot of numbers being thrown around. In addition to the $800 billion and the $700 billion, we're reading that the federal government has already committed to loans and rescues totaling $1.4 trillion. Then there's another number, $7.8 trillion in direct and indirect financial obligations from the government. So how much money has been spent?
Well, that $1.4 trillion number is the number that's been spent. And there are a few different things to keep separate here. The first is the government is taking on massive obligations here, but it doesn't always have to actually lay out money when it's doing so. In some cases, it's guaranteeing that if something goes bad, it will be there to backstop it. And some amount of that will actually go bad, and taxpayers will have to be on the hook for it. Much of it, we hope, won't. And the government is guaranteeing it as a way to calm some of the fears in the market.
So it goes into a column, but it's not spent.
That's right, but it might have to be.
Right.
The second thing is to keep in mind that in many of these cases in which the government is really spending, it will get back some portion of that money. And the TARP, the $700 billion program, is a good way to look at this. This isn't $700 billion the way $700 billion spent on the Iraq war or on Medicare would be, because that money never comes back. It is spent on health care or on tanks. This is a case in which the government is investing in banks. It's investing to buy these troubled assets. And at some point down the road, we'll end up selling its stakes. Sometimes in the past, the government has actually made a profit when it's done these investments. It did on the Chrysler bailout decades ago. I think in this case, it's unlikely to make a profit, but it's certainly not going to lose all of the money.
Well, what about the $800 billion? Because we're understanding that this money was supposed to jazz up the banking industry and help out with mortgages. But we understood that the reason that the government has had to come up with more money is that banks aren't letting go of it.
That's right. And this is a tricky problem because unless you nationalize the banks, it's pretty difficult to give the banks money and then to tell them what they must do with it. Banks exist to make a profit, and they can't make a profit if they are just holding on to their money and stocking it away. So we should presume that at some point they'll decide they want to make money, and the way they make money is making loans. But in the short term, it's not always so simple. If things get bad enough, you could imagine a situation in which the government would have to nationalize the banks, as happened in Sweden. Instead, what you want to do is you want to make it profitable for banks to lend, and you want to calm some of the fears.
Well, what are you seeing? Are you seeing anything yet? I mean, we said that the move to give out $800 billion more did spur a surge in refinancing, but are banks showing any signs that they're willing to refinance? And is the refinancing option going to people who are already in trouble, or is this for new, you know, some people who already have existing loans? How are you seeing it working?
It's a little early to say. I think the best thing to do is to keep in mind that the problems in the credit markets really peaked in October. That's when you saw mortgage rates go way up. It's when you saw these other more technical but in some ways more important measures of the credit markets like the TED spread go way up. They've since come down, but they've only come down to crisis levels as opposed to really terrible crisis levels. So the TED spread, which basically measures how willing banks are to take risks, should typically be essentially zero. It rose to 2 percentage points last year, then it spiked all the way up to 4 in October, and now it's basically back down to 2. Since the government's announcement yesterday, we've seen little tiny bits of more reasons for optimism. I think where we are now is we are still in essentially a crisis mode, but it is not as bad, not nearly as bad as it was about a month ago.
Well, we read today that new home sales are at their slowest pace in 18 years. Is that because the banks are gun-shy about writing the loans, or are people gun-shy about asking for them?
I think it's probably more the latter. Home sales have to fall enormously. The problem is that we had this housing bubble, and home sales got far, far too high. Home prices got far, far too high. And so while we do want to create sort of a floor for the housing market, the idea that home sales are falling and prices are falling is actually good and maybe even more to the point, unavoidable.
Well, what about the money itself, the, you know, the continuing bailout packages? Where's it coming from? Are they really just printing it, as some are saying?
In some cases, they are. I mean, the government has enormous resources. I think it's fair to say that in this case, both the Fed and the Bush administration have been slow. In some cases, they've even said, we don't want to do this, for example, inject capital into banks, because we think it's a bad idea. And then within days, they've turned around and done it. And that doesn't inspire confidence. But on the other hand, we also shouldn't expect that there's going to be some new program announced and then voila, this crisis will be over. That's not the way these things work. Bubbles are incredibly damaging things, and we had an enormous bubble. And we're not going to have a situation in which Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, or Timothy Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, gets up, announces a program, and then we can all wake up and the problem's over. It's going to be a lot longer than that. So it's not surprising to me that they haven't solved this yet. On the other hand, they haven't done the ideal job either.
Well, still, $800 billion on top of $700 billion and perhaps a few trillion here and there in guarantees. If this money's being, you know, printed, isn't it getting worthless?
That's certainly a worry. You certainly would worry that inflation would start to go way up. But there are now so many forces on the other side of this, which are essentially deflationary forces. The global economy is in a recession. Our economy in this country is almost certainly in the worst recession in almost 30 years. It may turn out to be worse than the recession of the early 80s. All that will serve to push prices down. Fewer people will be out wanting to buy things, and when there's less demand, prices have to fall. And so the printing of money does definitely raise the worry that money will get worthless, that we'll have inflation. But that really is tomorrow's problem, and they should be able to withdraw some of these stimulative measures that they've done as the economy strengthens. You think of it like a side effect. Taking the medication is better than the alternative.
And by the way, you mentioned the word stimulative. We just want to ask your thoughts on the fact that congressional leaders have changed the name of the stimulus package in Congress to the Economic Recovery Program.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's that meaningful. I think what they do is much more important than what they call it. I understand why they want to do that. Recovery is a nicer sounding word than stimulus. There was a similar discussion when they decided to change the name of the bailout. It wasn't going to be called the bailout anymore. They were going to call it the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program.
Or the rescue.
The rescue, that's right.
By the way, the thinking, according to some of the congressional leaders, was that stimulus sounded like shock therapy, and they wanted something that sounded more New Deal-ish.
Yes, well, usually when they change the words on these things, they go to something that is less accurate, and I would say that shock therapy is actually the more accurate description of what they're trying to do here. It's more serious than simply a recovery.
That's David Leonhardt. He covers business and the economy for the New York Times. David, thanks as always, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
And a quick program note, tomorrow on Here and Now, don't miss our story about a Vietnam-era veteran who lost his hand in war and then fought doctors who said he shouldn't make another sacrifice, donating a kidney to a complete stranger. We'll speak to both donor and recipient, both giving thanks. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we just heard, bailout may have fallen out of favor, but it still is the word of the year, at least according to Merriam-Webster Online. Hundreds of thousands of us looked it up, along with trepidation, precipice, and turmoil. And the word vet, as in vetting a vice presidential pick, came in second. Joining us to speak about this year's top 10 words, Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster Dictionary Online. How big was bailout? Are there perennials, you know, words that people look up every year that it surpassed?
Absolutely. In fact, there are sort of perennials that are looked up every day. Obsequious, quixotic, integrity. These are words that we see every day. And they become, in effect, kind of noise words. We see other words that are news-driven rising and falling throughout the day or throughout the week.
Well, that's a word like bailout really spiked. And you're saying that, you know, people had a general sense of what a bailout means. But what were they looking for?
Yeah, it's true that bailout is a pretty clear word. It's not a spelling issue, certainly, but it was part of the national conversation. And I think it's true that the word rescue is much more neutral, and bailout connotes blame. Something's questionable. I think there may be a case here where fairness and practicality in terms of government's response to the crisis are not exactly congruent. So what is fair and what is pragmatic are slightly different, and that raises questions in people's minds. And so our definition is quite simple, a rescue from financial distress. But I think the reason people were seeking more clarity with this word is because it does connote a blame of one kind or another.
Yeah, they were looking to see if there was a pejorative attached to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, that comes, I think, from the earlier sense of the word from the Second World War. Of course, the literal sense of bailout, an emergency departure and parachute descent from an aircraft aloft. And that's always done under duress.
Well, and we think also of bailing out a boat, you know, and there's no pejorative. That's a heroic thing. If you're bailing out the boat, going to save people. But bailing out someone else is maybe what people saw as pejorative. Also, at the same time, and off of stories about the economy, people looked up trepidation, precipice. And what does this say to you about, you know, what these past few months have been like?
It's extraordinary. I've never seen so many words with this kind of sort of fear and anxiety, a turmoil, as well as precipice and trepidation, and tumultuous just missed being in the top 10. So you can see that people are thinking about the times, and the times are difficult, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and it's really interesting to watch, you know, the words that surface every year, because bailout would seem to follow logically subprime, which was the American Dialect Society's pick for the word of the year last year.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it shows you that this is what people are thinking about. I mean, really, we're not a political organization or anything, but or a news group, but sometimes we can see from lookups when the public has sort of lost interest in a story. If there's a scandal, for example, or a large news item, we can see that the lookups will go for a day or two, and then they'll drop. It's oftentimes the news cycle goes another day. So there is a connection between what people are thinking and what they're looking up.
Right. Well, I'm looking at the list of the top 10 also included. We mentioned vet, socialism. People want to know, wait a minute, what is that again?
Sure.
But I noticed two words, maverick and rogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if they spiked with stories about Sarah Palin, for instance. And did people also want to know, wait a minute, is that a good thing or a bad thing when she goes all rogue on us?
Exactly. Rogue. Of course, there's also Rogue Nation, which has been in the news in the past year. But rogue certainly spiked towards the end of the campaign. Maverick was a spike earlier in the year, but certainly right as John McCain took the nomination.
And Peter Sokolowski, again, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster Dictionary Online. Tell us your favorite fun word that wasn't related to the economy or the campaign or the war that people just seemed interested in.
Solace from the James Bond title this year, Quantum of Solace. That came in at number 12, an enormous interest in the title of a movie. And that sometimes happens. The other thing is the history of these words is sometimes why people look them up. We can get the etymology at the dictionary definition. Vet, for example, does come from veterinarian, originally meaning to treat an animal as a veterinarian and ultimately to evaluate the health of an animal, which is how we have that derivation in political terms. And that's kind of an interesting history.
My favorite of all the lists from 2007, Sardoodledom, prompted by the National Spelling Bee, and Pecksniffian?
Pecksniffian. It was a character in Dickens, and it means someone who's unusually or harshly critical. And that was a word used by Bill O'Reilly, the cable news commentator. In a sense, news-driven, but not a word from the news.
I'm going to have to work it into a sentence. Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back with wordsmith Calvin Trillin in just a minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Writer Calvin Trillin, who goes by Bud, writes topical verse from a decidedly liberal point of view. He's The Nation magazine's deadline poet. He's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, NPR. His thoughts on the presidential campaign of 2008 are now collected in a book, Deciding the Next Decider, the 2008 presidential race in rhyme. It's a look back at the whole long presidential campaign of 2008. We're about to hear several excerpts, including this stanza from the poem World Tour about Barack Obama's trip to Iraq and Europe this past summer.
McCain maintained Obama was still green. He'd judged the war, although he'd barely seen the situation firsthand on the ground, so he should make the trip and hang around. Obama did, and playing with GIs, he sank a shot that came to symbolize the trip, a soaring set shot being tried by someone new who's shooting from outside.
And Bud Trillin joins us from his home in New York. Welcome back.
Thanks very much, Robin.
I guess the question is, in reading the book, you seem most sympathetic to Barack Obama, or let's put it this way, he seems the least ripe for sarcasm. What are you going to do now?
Well, I was thinking of maybe becoming an insurance claims adjuster or some other form of livelihood. I don't know. I think we'll be okay. He is difficult to joke about, and it's partly because he's so steady and calm, and usually someone who has a pretty steady personality and demeanor is obviously harder to joke about. But I'm willing to give it a try.
Well, boy, you have a cast of characters to choose from, a wealth of material to work with. For instance, I'm looking at page 81, how the Rove of Clones would have conducted an election campaign against Nelson Mandela.
Well, that's because the Rove method has always been to attack people's strength rather than their weaknesses. So they'd sort of sneer at just 29 years in prison, whatever it was, and what nice weather they had in Robben's Island, right there in the harbor of Cape Town. And they never quite knew what to attack on Obama. That was one of the problems.
Can we hear a little of the Rove of Clones deadline poem?
Sure. How the Rove of Clones would have conducted an election campaign against Nelson Mandela. This prison time Nelson Mandela bemoans, those years spent in labor like breaking up stones, were really not nearly as grim as you'd think. There's many worse ways to do time in the clink. Yes, sure, he broke stones. That is no real surprise. But fewer, we hear, than did some other guys. With that lovely climate, how bad could it be? It wasn't for life, or he wouldn't be free. So calling it martyrdom really is stretching. A few years in prison is no cause for kvetching. He won the Nobel, yes, but so did some Reds, some people who'd murder us all in our beds. How odd that he's honored in such far-off regions. The Nobel's the prize of a bunch of Norwegians. To win this election is now his priority. So spare us that bit about moral authority.
Calvin Trillin with his deadline poem on how Karl Rove, a spin master, might have spun Nelson Mandela if he was running against him. How much, as a satirist, will you miss Sarah Palin?
Well, there was a great moment in the campaign when Jon Stewart on The Daily Show said Sarah Palin, the Republican vice presidential candidate, and then he looked up and said, and godsend. Mm-hmm. I mean, Palin did provide some great material. There's a song in here that's a version of the Barbara Streisand standard, which is On a Clear Day I See Vladivostok.
I could hum it.
You can hum it in the background.
Yes.
Here it is.
Okay.
On a clear day I see Vladivostok, so I know world affairs. Don't say no way, though I know elites mock. It's osmosis that does it. Well, that and our prayers. And Joe Biden sees New Jersey from his shore, and that's just a state that doesn't rate. It's me who knows the score. On a clear day, on a clear day, I see Vladivostok and Novosibirsk and Krasnoyarsk and Novokuznetsk and Omsk and Tomsk and more. Of course, you can't see Russia from Alaska, as you probably know, except from one tiny island where she's never been.
Well, but is there a point where, you know, in writing these, you say, gee, you know, that was too easy, or maybe, you know, here's someone who did have a huge popularity rating as a governor and is definitely galvanized the Republican base. I mean, do you say, well, maybe I should take a more serious look, or is that just not what you're doing?
I don't take serious looks. I'm not in the serious look business. I mean, I did say after the her speech at the campaign, the Palin speech, her test, it was perceived, was well delivered and was well received. The people in the hall were quite ecstatic, and impact in the country was dramatic. She was a star, yes, managing to reach that special status after just one speech. Had anyone done such a thing before? Well, duh, Barack Obama in 04.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, we spoke to P.J. O'Rourke recently, who
right.
wrote a scathing commentary on conservatives, but also on liberals, and he, you know, just talked about them in personal ways, you know, that they don't value life, and they will all live on the south side of Chicago once Barack Obama is president. And I asked him if, you know, this kind of language was what's helped sink the conservatives, because that's what he was saying, they were sunk. And I guess the same thing to you. I mean, especially with the Democrats completely in power across the board, is that kind of, you know, poking at the Palins, the McCains, is that kind of not fair, too personal, too divisive?
Well, in the first place, this book isn't about when the Democrats were in control across right. the board, which they're not yet. They will be. And I think that generally people like me make fun of whoever is in power. The stuff I've written about George Bush is because he's been in power for 8 years. But I don't see that it's divisive to make fun of people. I don't think anybody, certainly John McCain doesn't think that. One of the saving graces of this whole thing was that he could go on Leno and or Letterman, whatever it was, and make fun of himself and be funny.
Well, and by the way, that may be the point, too, that it's making fun of the people in power, not average Americans. And, you know, there's a difference between making fun of the people in power and the poor schlep out on the street.
Well, absolutely. There's no reason to make fun of people who aren't in power or have some sort of power.
Well, so back to President-elect Barack Obama and what Calvin Trillin is going to do to make fun of him, because that's your job. And I'm wondering, with that in mind, what do you make of Joan Didion in the New York Times? And P.J. O'Rourke was quoted in the same column, Joan Didion saying that the U.S. in the Obama era has become an irony-free zone, and that's sort of like everything's off the table with the first, not just the first elected African-American president, but one who is so seemingly somber.
Not sure if he's somber. He's certainly, he's not funny. I think that there's a natural inclination to sort of see what's going to happen first before people start on people. But there was plenty to make fun of the Clinton administration, and I've been doing the Deadline poetry since 1990. So right. I started with George H.W. Bush and then went through 8 years of Clinton, and I didn't have any problem finding subjects in those years. I don't think I'll have any problem with Obama. And I mean, some people just have an odd view of the world, and it doesn't change with whoever's in power.
Yeah. Calvin Trillin, the Nation magazine's Deadline poet, also author of the new book, Deciding the Next Decider, the 2008 Presidential Race in Rhyme. Calvin, thanks so much for looking back and ahead with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to talk to you again.